Hello, Magfest. Welcome to the very first live recording of the Media Voices podcast. I'm your host, Chris Sutcliffe.
I'm Esther Thorpe.
And I'm Peter Houston, with your mate, Tom.
So, for those of you who don't know us, we do a weekly media-focused podcast called Media Voices, and it's kind of the reincarnation of the Media Briefing podcast, where we all work together beforehand. And we've had some fantastic guests. You know, we've had heads of Glamour UK, you know, Cosmo. Who else have we had?
We've had The Economist, The New Statesman, The Times, The Telegraph. I've got a whole list here if you want to go into that.
New European? I'm trying to think.
Facebook.
Jesus Christ. You went from no mic to the loudest mic in the world. And basically, we sort of take a half-hour look at what's happening that week in media news, and then we go to a guest. And, you know, you've heard some of the guests we've had, and they're fantastic. But this time, our guest is, well, it's you, because we're going to be talking about the future of free media. And Esther, if you could just start by maybe explaining what we mean by free.
Yeah, because nothing in life is free, is it? Let's be fair. I think in our approach to this, when we looked at free media, we thought, well, it's media that the audience don't pay for. So it's ad-funded, however you choose to do that. And that's the media that really over the last decade has absolutely plummeted. So what we want to take a look at is there a future for ad-funded media? Maybe we should call it that, but free sounded more dramatic. Is there a future for ad-funded media, and what does that look like? Who's doing it well? Who's not doing so well? Our usual kind of slightly irreverent take on it, isn't it?
Yeah, hopefully. And Peter, why is that important? You know, as people are looking to go behind paywalls, why is it important that there's still a free model?
Well, because even if you look at the New York Times, which is the utter poster child of paid subscription-based digital media now, only half of their revenue, I guess, at this point is coming from subscriptions. So they've still got ad funded on the other side of that paywall. And if you look at the traffic figures, it's this stupid number. It's like of 20 million visits in a month, 18 million are on the other side of the paid wall. So it's still important. It's definitely from digital. And then in print, well, that's the way these titles survive. So if we can't sustain them through ad funding, what's going to happen to some of those lovely publications?
Well, you've been a sort of magazine expert and enthusiast for what, coming up on a couple of centuries at this point. So what is the, you know, how have things changed over the last couple of decades? What is the,
well,
you know, how's the philosophy around it changed?
Absolutely. And I worked in controlled business to business qualified publishing before either of you were born in the 1980s. And, you know, it's always been there, and it was how these expert titles were funded. They went to someone who gave their name and their address, and they had to be qualified, and the advertisers were really after that, and that model worked really well. But it worked, I think, because there was a scale that made sense. It was, there are 20,000 engineers, so we'll do an engineering title and we'll send it to these people. And the economics of that worked really well. The problem comes when you go digital and that anonymous scale develops.
So was that just for more specific titles, or was there a sort of free genericized, you know, model out there?
There was less free, that's not a word.
Genericized? Yeah.
Freaking word. I don't remember a lot of free titles like that. You used to get and some listings titles that were free, but mostly it was the qualified stuff. Really, really specific. I have worked in my time on ophthalmology titles, chromatography titles, and pharmaceutical marketing titles, all qualified ad-funded.
I can't believe you've kept that secret. That sounds absolutely fascinating. What happened, though? So what was the sort of the transition from that to where we are now?
Well, what happened was the internet, and that idea that you've got John Smith over here, who's an ophthalmologist or a chromatographer, and I've got his address and I send him a magazine to drive-by traffic, which just, all the incentives changed. The incentives for publishing changed. It moved from get as many views as you can, which developed into clickbait, which developed into tracking, which all that utter crap that is destroyed digital advertising.
All right, but I guess we're going to get into that more in a little bit. But Esther, who is out there now who we think is doing really good free publishing in print?
Shortlist and Stylist.
I don't think Mike Suter's here. You don't have to.
No.
Hey!
I'm not doing that to suck up to him. It is genuinely... Stylist is the one print magazine I read. But it's also because I have to pay for it.
So. Wait, did you say the one print title you read?
Yeah.
Whoa, holy shit.
I'm a millennial.
Yeah. That's not a good enough excuse anymore.
I'm in the wrong place to say that, really.
Yeah.
It's the one print title I regularly pick up and kind of, you know, I will literally make sure I do a station detour to do it. Actually, that's not quite true. I read the Metro every morning as well. Sorry. Print magazine, though. So the Metro and the Evening Standard, whatever your politics, they are doing very well in their distribution models.
So actually, it might help if, at the moment, if we get sort of show of hands from the audience who regularly picks up a free title, whether that be when they go on public transport or whether that's because they...
Print title, yeah.
Yeah, okay, so good number. I mean, on the face of it, that looks like it would support a very healthy economy.
Listeners at home, we had a response rate of about 50%.
But there have been a lot of closures in the space at the same time. So some relatively high-profile ones as well, like NME... Regardless of, I mean, you think it lost its way a long time ago, really.
It's not that I think that, it did. What? The first free one had Rihanna on the front cover, for Christ's sake. NME had Rihanna on the front cover.
Yeah, this is actually not the first time he's had a bit of a rant about that.
Is Mr. McElhenney in the room? No, thank God for that. He would be telling you exactly what was going on there.
So what is the business model for a free print title, and why didn't NME cut it?
So it's really stupid asking me that question when this gentleman is sat here.
Yeah, exactly. Okay,
so
hang on.
Let me get the mic to Mike.
This is something we like to call enforced audience participation.
I don't know how you turn it on.
I don't know either.
Should you take that one?
There we go. Look at that, the power mic. What's the question?
So what about the sort of the model for free print distribution makes some titles viable and others not? What are the costs involved and why do some succeed while others fail?
I mean, free titles tend to work when they have a purpose, when the content is just excellent and award-winning.
When Rihanna's not on the front cover?
When they exist for audiences that are commercially valuable. So you can't, I think, have free magazines for kids, for example, because there's no marketplace there to support those things. And I think when you're really honest with your audience as well. So we were always really straightforward from the start with Shortlist, then with Stylist, which is, we're going to give you this great stuff that you can read for free, so it's free at the point of consumption. But the price to that, because it's being supported by advertisers, is, look at the ads, please. And we were really straightforward about it. And I think when you are, people aren't stupid. So when you are transparent about how you operate, how you make money, I think people really warm to that. And so we never had any pushback on, but what are all these ads doing here? So I think if you're honest about it, I think if you provide really good, distinctive content that has a real purpose to it, to a valuable commercial audience, I think you can have a very sustainable long-term business.
So is there a scale issue though? So I'm thinking, or any of the ones that failed, like Coach or NME or whatever, you need a certain level of readers. So I think Time Out, I don't know what you guys are doing, but Time Out used to do 300,000. Is there a number there that if you're on the wrong side of that number, you're not going to get the advertisers coming in?
Good question. Yes, there is. And I think the magic number is about 300 to 350. When we launched Shortlist 11 years ago yesterday, we set it at 500,000. Didn't know we could distribute that many. We could distribute that many, as it turned out. But the reason we did that was because at that particular time, you had things like FHM still selling around about 450,000. And we figured that we simply needed to be the biggest by scale in order to get advertisers over the line. Then, of course, the men's market dropped away. By the time we launched Stylist, we launched that at 400,000 because Glamour was selling just under 400,000. And so, again, we figured we needed to be the market leader. So I think, yes, definitely over 300,000. But it costs. You know, we go through, as a company, we go through hundreds of thousands of tons of paper every year. We employ 638 merchandisers part-time across the UK every week. These are big, big, big logistics.
That's the problem about free. It's not It's not free to do free, you know, from in a print sense. And that's part of why free digital was such a big deal.
I do think you've been hanging on to the phrase, it's not free to do free, though, for a while before we started recording.
I may have written it down a couple of times.
But what, I mean, there are still pressures on advertising, particularly around print. I mean, it was, if you look at what happened with the Evening Standard's latest results, they did blame a sort of a harder than expected, you know, a fall in advertising for their losses. So what is the sort of...
So should we just get Mike a seat? that's not daft.
So, I mean, is this something that is sustainable in the long term? Because even though there has been a slight resurgence in print advertising, if you look at latest AA Walk figures, that is, as Thomas Bechdel said, it's kind of related to one or two really big brands increasing their spending there. So why is advertising looking increasingly difficult for even free print titles? Nope. Longest question in the world.
Let me try and get some light in on that. The issues are not about total advertising revenues, because total advertising revenues for most print publishers are at worst flat. Mm. The issue is the nature of revenues. So what you are seeing across almost all markets is a decline, sometimes a gentle decline, sometimes a more steep decline of display advertising revenue. And what that's meaning is, in order to replace that revenue, you're replacing it with lower margin revenues that come from content solutions. And you know what those things are. They are advertorials and sponsorship and things which are created in partnership with brands. Now, they're brilliant things because rather than, say, taking £5,000 for a page of advertising, you can do a deal with a big brand for £500,000. But they're big and lumpy, and they come with big additional costs, because you might be running events, or you might be, you're creating content rather than simply taking the ads. So I think when you see the results of things like the Evening Standard, and they're struggling a bit, it's because of the nature of the shift in revenues as opposed to total revenue.
Yeah, and I think that's definitely true if you look at where they're actually, you know, some of the endeavours that they're launching lately.
So it's got nothing to do with their editor?
No, I mean, it might have something to do with the editor. I mean, fingers crossed.
Who's their editor again?
It's George Osborne, who I think is referred to on our notes as complete gobshite.
Yeah. Gobshite, that was that.
But I mean, who would have thought that putting a poo emoji in the weather wouldn't be a radical reinvention of that publishing strategy? Is there even space, though, in the market now for new titles? If you look at the kind of the ones that have failed, you know, there's only a finite audience out there for these titles. So, you know, is there even space for new ones?
Well, there's always space for new magazine titles. Is there space for magazine titles at the sort of scale that Mike is talking about? I don't know. You know, NME as a free title, if it had been the right free title, might have worked. I don't know. But I think it's very, very difficult to get the economics of that right.
Yeah, certainly. When it goes back to what you said about incumbents versus insurgents there, you do either have to have, you know, huge investment when you actually launch, or you're not going to really find a space in that market, surely.
You know, having the means to be able to launch and to launch at scale and to be able to invest properly in things. I mean, you know, when I think, if I'm being really candid about it, we raised £4 million. We kind of thought we might burn through two and a half. Mm. And we burned through 3.5. And that was because actually it was more expensive and more difficult to reach a kind of a critical flying speed than we expected before we really started to kind of you know, chip away at that cost. I've always been surprised that there haven't been more free launches. I've never expected the free or the freemium sector to ever be as big. I'd have as much variety as the paid-for sector, simply because that's a newsagent shelves as opposed to the pavements of major cities. But I have been surprised that there haven't been two or three more really significant new launches. Not relaunches like the NME, but new launches.
I think the other threat that a lot of these print magazines are facing, which I wonder maybe preventing freemium launches, is if you go to Tesco or Sainsbury's and you get to the end of the checkouts, there's a free Tesco magazine, there's a free Sainsbury's magazine, there's a free Waitrose magazine. This idea that brands that aren't traditional magazine brands can take magazines and use them as content marketing tools, It's like, well, if there's a free cooking magazine being handed out at the Tube, why would I pick that up when there's one at Tesco? And I think that is something that I think has come around in the last 5-6 years. And yeah, I think that's a big threat.
Certainly, if you look at the number of brands who are actually getting into it, the ones who've always done it, so, you know, High Life magazine, or you look at what Airbnb tried to do with Pineapple. Which...
Twice, and that's still not gone anywhere.
It's not called Pineapple anymore, is it?
No. Well, what was it?
It relaunched, and then I think it relaunched in a content partnership with Hearst, and I think we're still waiting on issue 2.
But that was very specifically a value add for, you know, Airbnb users, wasn't it? It was effectively a piece of content marketing. So there's, I think, fairly safe to say there's still room there for, you know, brands to actually want that kind of, you know, the allure, the kind of the halo effect of having a magazine. So there's still definitely room there.
And also the big issue when we come back to this with content marketing is that publishers are trying to make money from selling adverts, doing other things in these magazines. People who are using print magazines as content marketing have the money. All they're doing is trying to make a bit of extra money. So they can't, publishers can't compete with that kind of spend. Like the amount Tesco has to put that magazine out, and all it has to do is have a little uplift in sales. Whereas, yeah, it's so much more difficult if you're a publishing side and you're not making direct money from sales of that magazine or giving it out.
Oh, yeah, and that's the problem with magazine publishing. That's why everyone's coming to this conference trying to find an answer, is that idea of if you haven't got... Well, look at what's going on recently with Time being bought by a really, really rich guy, and the Washington Post being bought by a really, really rich guy, and the LA Times being bought by another really, really rich guy.
Are there any really, really rich women out there that want to buy a magazine?
The Steve Jobs wife.
That's the worst way you could have described her. That's
sorry.
Awful.
Sorry. Now I feel really bad.
Well, we also had, you know, what was it that Chance the Rapper bought the other day?
Oh, Chance the Rapper. We love him.
If only Chance the Rapper would buy every media title out there, then everything would be sorted. Yeah. But not quite there yet.
Especially since he announced that he'd bought it in a rap.
Yeah, just as a... If you've not listened to that, a man announcing that he's bought a media company by dropping 4 rap tracks about it is the best thing I've ever heard. Like, all media acquisitions should be announced that way from now on.
Do you want to give us a demonstration?
I do not want to do that.
Go on.
No. So we've been mainly talking about free print, and I think there's still a lot to unpack there. But, I mean, the same is kind of relatively true for digital. You know, there are so many free digital outlets out there. But if you look at the closures that have been in the free digital space, the outline, you know, what was the other one we were talking about just earlier?
Little things,
you know, all these titles that, all these online free sources that really felt like they had everything going for them that didn't end up working.
How have we got this far without mentioning Google and Facebook?
I don't know. Well, I mean, there's nobody from Google or Facebook in the room. Okay, so we can talk
shit. Would they even tell you if they were?
So, to play devil's avocado here, it's not going to work for... There's no easy solution even in digital, is there?
That's... You just heard today's understatement, folks.
So what?
No, it's a nightmare. It's an absolute nightmare. You know, you've got... So we're not just talking about Google and Facebook anymore. We're talking about Amazon. Mm. And Amazon's advertising ecosystem is ramping up ridiculously. Google and Facebook is taking all new digital advertising. So all the digital publishers, that is why there's this flight from ad-funded towards... paid content. But the problem is, and I can't remember the exact number, but something like 2% of your digital traffic is going to subscribe.
2-5%, I think it was DigiDay did a study on it a couple of weeks back.
See, I've got a memory.
I've got notes.
Notes, what are they? So you've still got 97.5% of your audience that you're not monetizing. So what are you going to do with them? And the problem with that in the past was the incentives came. If it's free, we've got to get traffic. It's anonymous traffic at scale. So you've got to basically be sensationalist. You've got to publish clickbait. You've got to create a website that looks like a game of whack-a-mole. There's that many ads popping up. And then you've got to get involved in all this insidious tracking bullshit. It's just awful.
Let me sound a small counterpoint to that. I think that there are really amazing opportunities in the free digital world to create sustainable long-term brands. But I think to do that, it's about the quality of audience. You don't always have to chase scale. And chasing scale can be an absolute mug's game because you're not in control. You're not the gatekeeper to social media. You're not Google. You're not those big platforms. And increasingly, you're not going to be Apple or Samsung or the actual device holders. And the device holders will be the ultimate arbiters of what will work and what won't. So you can still make money, but that can be a bit of a mug's game. Contrary to that, create something which has a valuable community that you have touch points with, so that it's not, you're not just doing one platform. You know, you might have web, but you might also have email around that. You might have some, you know, special print subscription around that. You might be able to sell tickets to events for all of those things. You can start to sell tools to people to do those things better. I think you can have really clear communities of interest, and I think you can still sell those to advertisers who will buy those packages because those are exactly the people that they want to get hold of. So I think there's something underneath that mass, you know, traffic chasing point, which I think is actually a very natural place for the magazine industry. Magazine industry's kind of often done that stuff. The big volume players in magazines are actually kind of outliers, you know? There's only ever been 10 of those, whereas there's always been 5,000 little guys who are creating businesses out of entertaining and educating niche groups.
So is there anybody who you think, and actually if anybody wants to shout from the audience, that is doing that really well, that you can sort of point to they've launched maybe in the last 5 years, who you think is actually fitting in that space?
The Pool.
You like The Pool a lot.
Pool,
we like
fantastic.
The Pool. Is there anybody else?
Shortlist.
No, not this one. Yeah.
I'm trying not to mention anything in the company that I chair, but things like Emerald Street are a really powerful example of that kind of business model where it has 100,000 plus active daily subscribers. And they are hugely engaged with the brand, and you can see it, and you can prove it. And we have, you know, there's a direct communication that we have, and there's real value in that because the Emerald Street team become then the gatekeepers of that. And again, they're very transparent. They can't be bought. They only write about things that they like. And when there are commercial messages, and there are commercial messages studded through it, and partnership emails, that's really clearly labelled, so people understand what the transaction is.
But the interesting part of that, whether it's Emerald Street or The Pool or whoever, the Skim's another one, it's not anonymous anymore. Mm. It might be free, but you've got an email address, you've got a direct contact with that reader.
That presumably is not an advantage that, you know, existed in the past.
This is like microphone musical chairs. It's brilliant.
I'm holding on to mine.
But so, I mean, effectively, they were saying that free online no longer means this kind of anonymous reach, this anonymous scale, that a lot of these titles can actually rely on a dedicated user base who they know intimately.
So the thought occurred to me the other day that actually, when I was researching for this, all the it's a bit of a generalisation, the titles that are struggling in print are actually the paid ones. You know, we've got months of ABC figures years of ABC figures that show that. And with the exception of some closures, the free titles are the ones that actually do really well. They're increasing circulation, they're increasing advertising. When you go onto digital, that's completely flipped around. So the titles struggling are the free ones. And the ones that are doing really well, the ones that have got that kind of reader revenue, got that reader relationship. I don't know whether that ties into that, in the sense of, was the anonymity of going online the big problem there? Once you lost who your audience were, that's it. What have you got?
Yeah, it was like, we had Adam Timworth on the podcast not too long ago. My voice broke then, I don't know why. And he said that, you know, the great tragedy of a lot of digital publishing is that before the rise of the platforms, outlets were actually genuinely making inroads into knowing their audiences, and they traded that for the anonymous scale that does come from on-platform publishing.
Facebook! I think the wake-up call, and, you know, people like Unilad are still struggling with this right
did
now.
Did you see that chart with their figures this week? When Facebook turned the dial down last August, it's just gone... They were completely Facebook first. They've got all over their website that they're proud to be Facebook first, but where's Facebook left them?
Well, they're very, very close to not being there. So the issue with that then is Yes, you can still operate at some kind of scale, but it's got to be, like you were talking about, and you put a number on it. It's 300,000 because we can afford the print, because that's how much advertising we've got. And I think the scale, digital scale, has got to be, we need that number to put that kind of money in, because we need that kind of content to support that money. And that's the oldest publishing model in the world, the three-legged stool, where you've got content, audience, revenue, and they support each other. And if one leg doesn't work, if one leg's too short, the whole thing falls over.
I think the other thing that you can do is the future of media and magazine media, I think, is going to be a really mixed ecology when you look at the underpinning business model. So later on in the conference is going to hear from the wonderful Mark Frith, who runs Radio Times. And, you know, Radio Times is, as in terms of the modern case study for a way that you invest in the right things, that you take money directly from consumers, but that you also engage them in really tangible ways and understand them on their online behaviours, I think is almost unparalleled. I mean, I could now go over and Mark could come and sit up here if you...
Yeah,
go on then. Here we go.
We're talking about musical chairs.
Mr. Mark Frith, everybody.
Just to prove we've actually got an audience.
Do you want to lead from that, or is there a sort of...
it's something that we've invested in. It's something that is... we wanted to grow Radio Times Universe, so the audience online is considerably wider than it is in the magazine. Although the magazine obviously still has the reputation of being the quality guide to TV and radio. What we wanted to do with online is we wanted to make it the voice of entertainment. So, you know, if you want to know what the best films are on Netflix, if you want to know when a show that you're seeing being trailed heavily is going to be on, you'll probably go to us. And 78%, I think, of the traffic is organic. So it kind of, you know, we get people who just come into our world who probably hadn't before, and we just hope they stick around and see us as the source they want. But it's, you know, what it's done to the brand, how it's reinvigorated the brand and taken it into other areas from where the magazine has been seen as being. It's been wonderful, and it's won, deservedly won awards, you know, for that.
So, I mean, is it fair to say then that the kind of the real value of these audiences that you reach that way is that, well, A, you know them, but also that you can launch new products and services around them? So if you look at, say, what kind of Time Out's been doing with food markets and everything, there is an opportunity there to really use your free touch points to connect with them and then launch new products around that.
Yeah, not necessarily just new products, new initiatives as well. So we've been working with Sky this year. One of the visions I had, I've been in the job a year and a few days, and one of the visions I had during the interview process was, wouldn't it be great if people could watch the first episode of a TV show ahead of everyone else via Radio Times? Quite a lofty ambition. Who on earth is going to give us their TV shows they've spent millions and millions on? But it happened. We've done it twice now. So we did it in March with Patrick Melrose. You could watch Patrick Melrose episode one via the Radio Times website for free. Even if you didn't have a Sky subscription before it was on TV. And then we've done it again in the last 2 weeks with a show called Discovery of Witches. And we went live with that at 2 a.m. Last Friday. And by 10 a.m. we'd had 700 people. 700 people had watched the whole show between 2 a.m. and 10 a.m., which is just insane. Yeah. And we're now up to, I think, about 11 or 12,000 in just a few days. So, and that has commercial, we should point out, that has commercial value. They pay us for that. They pay us so that we can do that. So it's kind of not just new products, but it's new initiatives as well. So them, the audience will so much see us as the home of entertainment. They can watch TV shows with us before they see them on TV. That's a great position for us to be in. There are too many ways that people can circumnavigate Radio Times to get to TV and radio, and I my big vision is just to get, you know, to cut off those points, and you have to access TV and radio through us to get to TV and radio in whatever form, whether it's information or video or whatever. You have to go through the Radio Times brand. That's the vision.
I think you've given me a fantastic idea for a new title that publishes exclusively between 2 a.m. and 10 a.m. Really going after that lucrative Insomniacs market.
Well, maybe, but it's yeah. We just didn't expect that number. It was, that's quite a thing, and that's so to come in the next day and be told 10, half 10 or whenever it was, I was told that it was 700 people already. You think that's great. We got hit on our hands. People are starting to realise, you know, Radio Times is a place where they can watch TV shows as well as get information about when they're starting.
There are, it's relatively rare, but there are a few people and there are a few smaller organisations that have genuinely launched kind of, what's smaller than an empire? A Maisonette. They've launched media Maisonettes on platforms. So I'm thinking of, you know, people who exist primarily on, you know, YouTube, or, you know, if you look at what kind of Young Turks has done based around YouTube. Is there space for people to grow their own free media, their own free magazine type content on these platforms specifically, or are you going to be over reliant on them forever?
Yes. No.
I mean, definitely, because you're clearly reliant on them. You know, what Mark's talking about there doesn't work unless you are the Radio Times. What you're talking about doesn't work unless you're PewDiePie, but you're always going to be PewDiePie on YouTube.
You know, we started this discussion by asking what is going to be the future of free. So where will free content continue to exist? Will it be in print? Will it primarily be digital? Is it going to be based around what the platforms dictate us?
I think that you're coming at that from totally the wrong point of view. It's not about the platforms. It's about the content. What Mark has just described is one of the best ideas I've ever heard in terms of publishing, where you take a brand, not just saying that because he's bigger than me, you take a brand, you take an audience, you take a bunch of content, and it works for everyone. And the platform, in a sense, is only determined by the message that you're trying to get across. You could have done that on YouTube, but you didn't, because then YouTube would have owned it. So I think publishers, from a publisher's point of view, they've got to take back control. This is the resistance.
Should we get that on a T-shirt?
Yeah, that's a T-shirt.
I would be amazed if he didn't already own it on a T-shirt, to be honest. So, I mean, what then? But isn't that kind of just that's the woolly thinking that got people into a mess originally, right? Is going, well, content is king and everything like this.
No, the woolly thinking that got people into trouble in the first place was chasing scale, because they forgot who they were. They thought, we can be everything to everyone. The example I always use regularly is Team Rock, the music titles, who had something like 5 million reach on social, but they couldn't make it work. So they got sold. Future sold them for £10 million 1 year, and 3 years later, Future bought them back for less than £1 million. But they had grown their social reach by 4 million people. So,
in the notes, you kind of single out the Telegraph for their approach to freemium publishing.
Yeah, I know.
So what's good about that? What makes that work? Whereas, you know,
it's actually the
unreplicable,
only thing
rather.
That's good about the Telegraph, to be honest, is that model. They talk about they don't have a digital paid content strategy. They have a digital strategy, and that works as this mix of charging £2 a week or £2 and whatever it is. I guess it's £2 a week for premium access, but then everything else is open. And they view their revenue models against both sides of that. They're not just going down one route. And I think that, okay, Mark can talk about this, because you're selling the print and giving the digital away for free. So that idea of a mixed model.
Yeah, it's something I don't have experience of, working in that kind of paywall, just as I don't have experience working in free magazines before. I'd actually want to pick up on your point about social, actually, and rocketing social numbers having very little worth. I have to agree with that. I think people haven't. It's very difficult, apart from as a promo tool, to find out actually how social can help you. Because, you know, the example of Team Rock, I think, is an incredibly pertinent one, where, you know, they were shouting about how the social numbers had increased in the way they had, but it wasn't really worth anything at all. And we certainly use it in a promotional way, and it kind of works for us, and there's a bit of a community element there as well. but does it sell your product? Does it increase your worth as a company if you're looking to sell or whatever? It probably doesn't, actually. And I think that it is a it's a red herring for a lot of people, actually. People who get too excited about their social reach and then think, well, actually, do you know what? We're not making a penny from that. That is just, we've wasted a fair bit of time on something that is at best a promotional or marketing thing, but even then, only under the right circumstances.
Yeah. I think video will end up exactly the same way. Well, apart from the people that are already doing it, we'll end up turning around in a couple of years and saying, why were we as publishers creating these videos, like, you know, pumping huge resources into these video teams? Because actually, I'm sure there's a stat about one publisher that put out a video and it got 2.5 million views, and they made about £4 from it. Like, if it's not making money, why are you doing it? That's a horribly mercenary way to think about it. But
so I think it was the Reuters Digital Leaders Survey found that I think it was 10% of organisations are planning for a future without advertising in any form. But the reality is that that's probably not going to work. There's you know, relatively low propensity to pay for things online, particularly for news. So, I mean, people are going to have to make advertising-based models work. So what's it going to take to do that?
But isn't that a classic publishing bandwagon thing? Oh, we're all going on the platforms. Ta-da! Oh, we're all going for video. Ah, down this road, guys, quick. Bang, straight into a cul-de-sac.
It's podcasts now.
And paid content, there's a danger that paid content is going to be the same thing. The FIP, there's a FIP annual report, comes out every year. That's because it's annual. and one of the lead pieces on that is John Wilper's saying, if you're not in paid content, you're done. And I know John, and he's a lovely guy, and he's a really, really smart guy, but that's wrong. It's horses, you can't say this as a Scottish person, but it's horses for courses. It's not horses for courses. Anyway, the point is the model's got to fit whatever media you're in. And to mix in ad funding and paid and some other stuff is what publishers have always done.
You think, okay, so even with Google kind of dictating the form and function of a lot of advertising, you think it's possible to do advertising well, or are we talking about branded, well, sponsored stuff?
I'm not sure, yeah. I think there's loads of different ways to do that. Right now, any improvement is going to improve the way people view advertising. People hate advertising now because how many people in the room have been followed around the internet by a toaster that they bought a fortnight ago? Everyone has. And that is just the tip of the iceberg of how shitty online advertising is.
You know, my friend actually did get followed around the internet by an advert for a holiday that he had previously been on and bought it again, went back the next year. It's literally his fault.
It's his fault. Oh, no. So any improvement to that has got to be good, but there's other ways of doing this. You're going to get people like my absolute publishing crush, The Correspondent, who will have no advertising because that's the model. But then you've got other people who have got mixed models where you've got subtle advertising, relevant advertising, well-managed advertising. I think that can work. I don't think anyone in this room is against advertising per se.
I think the problem you get with that is that you only need one or two publishers doing the route where you literally can't move on an article for all the adverts to hit the ad block button. And that ad block button, it doesn't matter how good your adverts are, how relevant they are, how pretty they look on the page. I've installed it already because one person mucked up the experience for everybody else.
We've got to ask the audience about this. Ad blockers. Who uses an ad blocker? Oh, my wow. God, that is quite a lot.
But it's like you said, you only need the one bad experience. And I think what it was Oath found that it cost UK publishers £630,000 last year.
And that's just the UK publishers?
Yeah, it's just UK publishers. So, I mean, is it fair to say that in order for free online to become relevant and kind of viable, we do have to take action and sort of say, well, this is, you know, we need to kind of do a bit of a mea culpa and say we need to clean up that space?
Yeah, I think so. You know, if you're going to put people off coming there, then there's a kind of a problem with that. Yeah, it feels like a burning topic. I mean, that was a large number of people put their hands up here that use ad blockers, and that's obviously a big live issue, I think, for people.
So, I mean, I think that if we've got anything out of the kind of this future of free session, it's that everybody understands that there has to be a future for free. There will only be a certain number of international publications and only a certain number of magazines in any given space that can support themselves through paid models, so there has to be a free model.
Oh, I feel like we've covered like at least 6 or 7 special episodes worth of content in this. But Chris Duncan, who is heads up the Times, he did an article for the Drum a couple of months back, and he said, well, there's got to be a future for free, because if everybody puts up a paywall, only sort of around 10 worldwide organisations will survive that. Because, you know, I love this argument, but if I've had to pay a subscription to everything I read, I'd be bankrupt by the end of the month. And I know, as somebody involved in media, I probably read a lot more than average. But I'd be really interested to see, the more and more people that put up the paywalls, what happens to those free titles? You know, do they grow? Do the paywalls grow?
Well, isn't the problem there that, you know, once these quality titles do go behind paywalls, that the incentives to produce kind of, you know, the information pollution, you know, the kind of acrid byproduct you get, which is the result of DMGT transforming, you know, fleeting audience attention into paltry ad revenue and kind of hangs around in the atmosphere, poisoning everybody, that there is the incentives to produce that become much more acute, and we are going to see much more of that kind of stuff.
I'm sorry, I was just looking for this quote, because I do actually love your notes, Esther. There's a book, I've never read it, but Sapiens and Homo Deus, and this guy that wrote this, whose name I'm absolutely going to butcher here, Yuval Noah Harari. And he's just, in this new book, he's talking about 21 ideas for the 21st century. He says the idea of free information is extremely dangerous. If you want good information, pay good money for it. So whether that means it's only paid information, it means there's a trade-off. And if you're going to accept that free information, then maybe you need to accept that unless you get behind a brand who's clearly investing, like Shortlist or Stylist or whatever, or Radio Times that's doing really cool stuff for free online, you're going to expose yourself to clickbait, to nonsense, because it's still going to be about scale.
So I actually put this to, we interviewed Alan Hunter back in July, plug, and he's head of digital for the Times, and they've obviously been doing paywalls for decades. And Chris, your thing is that, well, paywalls are undemocratic. You know, we have a right to information. And he pointed to the BBC. Well, he said, you know, in this country, we're very lucky to have the BBC, which is open to everybody. But the BBC isn't actually free, is it? It's reader-funded in the most roundabout way.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And it's also, you know, it takes for granted that the idea that the BBC will be around in its current form, but effectively for eternity, you know. It's not necessarily going to.
Of course it will, it's British!
And they're struggling at the moment because the more people that pick up Netflix, you know, have got the cord cutters, and they're thinking, well, I don't need to pay my licence fee. Mm. And that's, you know, the growth of that in this country is, I mean, wait for the next 2-3 years.
There is an entire separate special about kind of the future of the BBC and Netflix and everything. I think at this point it might be worth it, if anybody has any thoughts about kind of anything we've spoken about, or maybe, you know, the future of free media, and kind of wants to raise their hand, maybe make a comment, that would be great. Otherwise,
we have eight minutes until lunch.
Come on, people.
Got one at the back.
Yeah, hang on, I'll Nicky run over there 1 second.
Sorry, we'll edit this out, don't worry about it.
You mean edit out the walk as opposed to my question, Peter? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So you're talking about any improvement to advertising is an improvement. What kind of recommendations would you have for small publishers who are not necessarily reliant on the advertising income they're getting from Google, but see it as a good source for really turning that around and making it all about their product and making, you know, regaining ownership?
I think the model that Mike talked about with the newsletters is a really interesting one for smaller publishers, because you can do stuff with newsletters that still lets you maintain that reader contact, the relationship. Yeah?
I think a lot of it as well is about knowing your audience. You know, the smaller a publisher you are, the more likely you are to be able to reach out to those people, find out who they are, find out what they like, and that is then I don't want to say it's an easier proposition to take to advertisers, but you can say, you know, we know who these people are. It's why one of the reasons Niche is doing so well is because you've still got advertisers who want to reach these people. And yeah, it's a lot more appealing a prospect than some of the mass market magazines, if you know your audience.
Does anybody have any other comments or questions?
I remember a time when down in London, we would face about, it seemed like four or five different people trying to hand you out free newspapers outside every subway underground station. Do you think, I mean, the fact that most of them disappeared before the Evening Standard went free, would the Evening Standard have gone free and survived if any other publications had still been in that market?
I'm coming out. I think it would have been incredibly tough. It was a crazy period, wasn't it? It was an absolutely crazy period. And it was a lot of it, I think, just came from the competitive streak of the people involved in a kind of self-defeating way, and a load of money was wasted. I think there was just a craze at the time for free stuff, and I think that it was there was a lot of naivety that went into it. People thought we can do newspapers that people will pay for, and of course we'll do even more that'll be given away free and in greater numbers, and they were badly wrong.
It was a massive willy-waving exercise between Murdoch and the Daily Mail General Trust, because there was the London paper and the London Eye, was it? I can't remember now. What was that? I can't remember the second one. There were two evening papers, and then you had the Standard at the same time, which was struggling to pay for. But they basically, zero-sum game, they cancelled each other out. But what they did do, brilliantly, was create a London hand distribution network. And when they folded, some other people came along with some magazines. So hurrah for that newspaper award. And
was that part of your thinking, that being there, that being in place, did that help you?
Oh, the most amazing. We basically employed the people who did the London paper.
So could you have launched if that hadn't have been in place?
It did two things. So one was it created a network with a kind of an underpinning technology that meant that you could track what was happening, which existed and was just off the shelf. The second thing was it persuaded advertisers that actually there was value in high frequency print publishing, which was free, because up until that point, as we've discussed already, most free things were, well, it's free because it's not very good. And so they were able to prove to advertisers that it could be high quality and free.
In which case, Mike, I think you'll be able to answer this one. Can free work outside of London?
Ooh, that's a really big question. I think free cannot work outside of urban conurbations, because you need audience and you need people to act. The proof of free media is engagement, and the proof of engagement is when people do something. They buy a product, they do something with it. So you need a critical mass of people. In the UK, I think it's really difficult to see anything of scale that's going to make, you know, millions of pounds worth of EBITDA on an annual basis existing without being in London and having London at its core. We launched Stylus in joint venture with Group Marie Claire in France, and the same thing was true of France with Paris. You know, 60% of the circulation of the distribution is in Paris. Same sort of thing with London and the southeast. I think it is possible to have smaller, more niche businesses which are free. It can be based in Edinburgh and Glasgow and Manchester and so on and so forth. But the underpinning cost base and overheads for those things, I think, would need to be in kilter with the scale of potential revenues.
Well, I mean, I don't think we're going to be willy waving, so it's probably a good time to sort of wrap this up. it's. I just want to say thank you all for coming to this first ever live episode of Media Voices. Normally, we don't record in the same room. Sometimes we don't even record in the same country.
This is our first time actually all sitting in a room recording together.
Yeah, normally we record in dressing gowns. You know, I live above a kebab shop. I have to edit out the noise of the chimney, which is an absolute nightmare. Yeah, thank you very much for coming. Please do check us out. We are on iTunes. You can go to voices.media to find us. But I guess until next week, well, this week is going to be...
What have you forgotten to mention?
What have I forgotten to mention?
The newsletter.
Oh, that's right. Please also sign up to our weekly newsletter, which goes out every Wednesday. You can sign up to that by going to voices.media. But until next week,
oh,
well, we...
Twitter.
Jesus Christ.
Twitter.
All right, until...
What's the matter with
that? Or go to at Media Voices Pod on Twitter, where you can find us. Or rather, you should be able to find us individually as well. We tend not to shut up on Twitter, just as we tend not to shut up on stage, it turns out.
And I'd thank love you to both of you as well.
Yeah, I was just
going to
say thank you to impromptu guests that just got dragged off the floor.
I would say hostages, really,
almost.
More than anything else. But until next week, when we're going to be back with another fantastic guest. Thank you very much for coming, and goodbye.
Thank you. Woo!